Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandaisy.
And we are the Shock Doctors. In this episode, we're going to be discussing Peter Strickland's last film, In Fabric, which, like any of his films, and perhaps more so than any of his prior features, is fucking weird.
It's out there. Yeah, no getting around it. No two ways about it.
It follows a demonic dress.
A murderous dress, yes.
That's the simplest way to put it.
The dress is the closest thing the film has to a protagonist, which is kind of charming. And it's really not pitched that way. I was quite taken aback when the woman I took to be the protagonist doesn't stick around as long as I thought she might.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's the elevator pitch. I don't know if you have any other preliminaries or if you just want to get to it.
I don't think so. I mean, it reminded me, the elevator pitch that I was presented with, or maybe the one that I just mistakenly inferred from what snatches of advertising I saw, was that it was going to be, I for whatever reason, associated it with bad hair. I thought that it was going to be like a parable of some kind, like a cautionary tale, you know, but instead of a killer weave, it's a killer dress, but it was going to have something to do with vanity or femininity or something like that. And indeed it might, but it's not as loaded.
Overt.
As overt as anything like that. You can enjoy it just as a movie about a dress that's up to no good. Migrating from victim to victim. So, without further ado, we open with some rather beguiling opening credits. I have to say, it evokes the 70s, and the font and the music is exactly right. Very giallo.
Yes.
And it's a succession of still images that I assumed were taken from the film proper, although
I think some of them are.
Some aren't, yeah.
Going back to the soundtrack real quick, purportedly it is by Cavern of Sound or something to that effect. If
something a little more ostentatious than that, throw a couple other words in there.
It opened with the word cavern.
Yeah.
But I swear to God, if it had just said original music by Goblin,
yes,
I would have been completely unsurprised.
Yeah, a little Tangerine Dream, a lot of Goblin. So it evokes the 70s. I think my favorite opening credits 70s pastiche of recent years is still Ty West's House of the Devil.
I thought you might.
Isn't quite on that level, although it's still good fun. We meet Sheila. She is a middle-aged divorcee with a son, 20-something son, who lives with her. And he's got this model girlfriend who is getting on Sheila's last nerve, drinking all her booze and going through her things and just basically kind of elbowing her out of her own life.
Yes. I think her son's a little bit younger than that, actually, because the girlfriend talks about him having to study for his A-levels, which I'm pretty sure is like high school graduation exams for getting into university.
I remember her saying that. I just did not know what A-levels were.
Yeah.
Well, not being a Brit.
I'm secretly British. I have been this whole time. I have a much better American accent than Benedict Cumberbatch.
Hopefully a better
chakras
British accent.
And the power of belief. So that's been a beef of mine ever since the Doctor Strange trailer first came out 5 fucking years ago.
I'd wager you also have a better British accent than Easter Gay.
Perhaps.
Sheila is responding to personals, you know, blind date ads, Lonely Hearts stuff without much success. She goes on a succession of really lousy first dates.
I think it's really just the one, but it's so bad that it feels like she went on 5. This guy named Adonis.
Well, even the dates that go better than the Adonis date aren't like slam dunks. There's still a fair degree of awkwardness.
Well, I feel like there's Adonis and then there's the one other guy that's like kind of awkward, but they seem to get along.
All right, so not a slew. All right, I retract that.
But yeah, again, this Adonis guy, it's just like,
he's an eternity unto himself.
This date could not have gone much worse. I'll just leave it at that.
It could have been a little worse because when she's going through the personals, she circles Adonis's ad and the one underneath it, the guy is billing himself as a huggable, malleable dermatologist. It's like, what are you made of, clay? I thought at first that was some Joker's idea of lorem ipsum text. that was supposed to be out of focus. They weren't supposed to read that, but it's think just Peter Strickland being a weirdo.
Yeah, I think so.
What, ideologically malleable, maybe? I'll believe whatever you want me to believe.
Maybe that's just a really arch way of saying he's chubby.
It could be.
You know,
people in this
he's
film
squishy,
do,
he's malleable.
Do often speak in galactically arch ways, just unbelievably arch ways.
We'll get to the most standout example of that in not too much time.
Let's go there now, as a matter of fact. Sheila goes to this ritzy clothing store, this boutique, and is set upon by a saleswoman who, it's like Sheila's buying a dress from a character in a Matrix sequel. She talks like the architect or the fucking Merovingian. Everything she says is so ornate, comically so. Quid pro quo, vis-a-vis, ergo.
I have pulled up the memorable quotes IMDb page for In Fabric.
Voluminous, I'm sure.
Actually, no.
No, that tracks, actually. This is not like a smash hit.
Right, but all of the quotes are from this character whose name is Miss Luckmore. Did the transaction validate your paradigm of consumerism? Which makes it sound much more like this movie is just, let's riff about consumerism, which it does somewhat, but that's not really representative.
Well, but every time she talks, you know, she's got this kind of, it's not French, what is it? She's got this like vaguely pan-European accent,
right?
And a lilting voice. So everything she says aloud kind of plays more like poetry anyway.
Well yeah.
The word consumerism doesn't jump out at you very conspicuously.
Dimensions and proportions transcend the prisms of our measurements. The hesitation in your voice, soon to be an echo in the recess in the spheres of retail. I'm going to stop there. That's the best one that they have in the list. But it's just, she has a lot of dialogue.
Gobbledygook.
And it's all gibberish. And yet she's got this pan-European accent, so it is periodically, like, difficult to understand on a word-by-word basis.
Well, and the accent sounds snooty and erudite enough that it makes you feel stupid for not keeping up, even though you're pretty sure that it's nonsense.
So yeah, it's like two levels of difficult to understand,
right?
And then yes, she sounds like she knows what she's talking about, and therefore you are a moron.
And my favorite line of hers is when she's trying to sell this red dress, the murderous dress of the elevator pitch, and she says that it, you know, in her usual verbose way, in wearing it you will accomplish many things at once. You will be, I don't remember what she says, you will be as enticing as a waterfall but as formidable as a statue, something along those lines. Ergo, you will destroy two birds with one stone. Destroy,
not kill. Vaporize,
obliterate, wipe off the face of creation. Nary a feather will be left behind.
I'm going to kick your ass off the earth.
Yeah. So there's a lot of malice dripping off of this woman. And her second in command, I took him to be, who just looks like Dracula. Just looks like a 7.5 foot tall vampire.
Well,
man.
They have a weird relationship because sometimes it seems like she's in charge and sometimes it seems like he's in charge.
And because it's a Peter Strickland movie, there's like an undercurrent of kink maybe there, so,
or an
possible
overcurrent.
So maybe they're like they're switches. I don't know. I have a feeling that river flows both ways.
Yes,
overcurrents and undercurrents. So this date with Adonis does not live up to his namesake. First of all, he's just a regular middle-aged dude and kind of a sourpuss at that. He's more sullen than her son. You know,
yeah.
More tight-lipped and standoffish than her teenaged son, who she doesn't get along with. So it's the opposite of a relaxing night out. And he brings her the most pitiful floral arrangement. It's like a shrink-wrapped rose, wilted and drooping in this crinkly plastic.
He fishes it out of a pocket in his briefcase.
Uh-huh. Has not been getting a lot of sunlight.
Well, it's not even like it was poking out of the pocket either. It looks like it was shoved down in the pocket,
mm-hmm.
crumpled up, and it, you know, hands it to her, and it's like bent at the middle. It's just, it's awful.
We start jumping back and forth between Sheila's travails and weird interludes with the woman who sold her the dress and her whole sphere. They're not all worth recounting. The first is she's standing in front of a mirror. She takes off her wig. She's bald and she starts behaving oddly, has a little bit of a jump scare freak out in front of the mirror where all of a sudden her fingernails come up in this kind of tiger-ish fashion. And then she loads herself into
a dumbwaiter
sarcophagus of sorts.
She bends at the waist and like has her head against the floor of the dump. I don't know how to describe it. It's It looks like she's prostrating herself before an emperor inside a dumbwaiter,
which then descends into the bowels of this place fucking department store. Yeah, right, exactly. So Sheila gets a rash after wearing the dress on her disastrous date, and she's playing a board game with her son and his girlfriend, and things are tense. She's washing the dress, and the washing machine starts thrashing around and making strange whirring noises. It sounds like an electrical fire is about to break out, and the machine just starts tearing itself to pieces.
Yeah, dress one, washing machine zero. Yeah,
so she comes in to see what all the commotion is about after the board game has come to a head. It's one of those... Yeah, it's one of those classic horror movie moments where some kind of domestic dispute is escalating in tandem with some unrelated supernatural thing. So the tension is ratcheting up on two fronts. Runs into the laundry room, tries to extricate the dress from the washing machine, and slices her hand open on an exposed piece of sharp metal. And the washing machine just goes full mangler and literally destroys itself like a bird being hit by two stones, or whatever the expression is. I didn't mangle it that much like, worse than the...
Like a bird being destroyed by a stone.
Yes.
At the same time as another bird. I don't remember exactly when it is, but there's one more...
If it's the one I think you're thinking of, then it's right about now.
Okay. There's one more vignette with the terrifying saleswoman where she and...
And her Nosferatu friend.
And her Nosferatu friend and a group of women dressed very similarly to her where they're sensually anointing a mannequin.
Yeah, they're fondling... I think headless mannequin, unless I'm... It might have had a face on it, I'm not sure.
I think it had a face, but it might have been, like, missing arms. I don't think it was complete. I think you're right in so far as that.
What it does have that most mannequins don't, I assume, is pubic hair.
Well, that's the least of it. So they're, you know, rubbing all over its mannequin breasts, and then the woman starts administering heavy petting. Rubbing the mannequin down.
We watched the unrated version. We had a choice between the NC-17 and the R. And, you know, we go big or go home here on the Shock Doctors podcast. We want all the smut all the time. Sign us up.
So the mannequin is wearing panties and she pulls them down. And yes, we discover, first of all, that it has pubic hair, which is weird enough. It's around this time that Nosferatu, who has been watching this whole time and...
Making O faces in the background.
He slides a hand into his pants and begins masturbating. Suddenly, the panties are all the way off, and we see that the mannequin has a vagina, which is menstruating. The saleswoman starts fingering it, and then the climax, and I choose that very pointedly, sure, of this scene is a cum shot. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's there's no other way around it. It's like a shot of just black empty space, and then just cum is flying across the frame. So I mean, I guess that's about as tastefully as you can shoot a cum shot in
abstractly
a film.
Yeah, but in isolation,
it's still incredibly unsettling. And yes, the R-rated version and the quote-unquote unrated, it also said NC-17, so I don't know which it is, but the difference between the versions was about a minute. I'm guessing it was 1 minute of this scene.
That's a fair assumption.
Particularly, again, the cum shot. I can't imagine that that was in the R-rated version. No, and I don't think the MPAA would let that slide.
Nothing else in the NC-17 is anywhere near that smutty or that hardcore, I guess I should say. You know, hardcore in the proper sense, you know, in the pornographic sense.
Right.
So we leave the semen demons behind for now. Sheila is getting chewed out by her bosses at the bank where she works. She's been accused by some snake of a coworker of not clocking out before she goes to use the loo.
Which is fucking ludicrous. Like, at what job are you actually required to clock out to piss? That's fucking psychotic.
Well, and I'm trying to wean myself off of this word because it's one of those words that I find very easy to overuse. But this job does increasingly become Kafka-esque.
I think that is a legitimate use of that term.
I try to use it with surgical precision.
I think you hit the nail on the head. Because
later,
this case,
in a scene that we might not get around to, she is being read the riot act for waving at not even a superior, the mistress of a superior who technically outranks her because she's stooping her superior.
It was an insolent informal greeting.
It was an insolent salutation.
Thank you. Yes, just fucking unreal.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, these scenes, they're like through the looking glass versions of John C. McGinley and the other guy
the
in
Bobs.
Office Space.
Exactly.
The Bobs.
That's what I thought. Bob's your uncle in this case. Like, yeah, no, I got powerful Office Space energy off of these scenes.
But these guys are so much more ominous.
Mm-hmm.
The Bobs are just kind of goofy.
Let's see. Is this where she tries to return the dress? My notes are occasionally too cryptic for my own good.
I mean, it was around this time. I don't think the beats matter so much.
She learns that the woman who wore the dress previously was killed at a zebra crossing. The headline reads, catalog model killed at zebra crossing.
I don't know what a zebra crossing is.
I'm inclined to take it at face value. It's a zebra thoroughfare.
But they're in London. Where the fuck is there a zebra crossing?
Might have been on safari. I don't know. Maybe it was a zoo exhibit gone horribly awry. In any case, reading catalog model killed at zebra crossing is what made me realize, oh, I guess malleable whatever was not lorem ipsum text. Because this is a headline. You know, it's you can't miss it. So she goes on a second date that goes more successfully. She actually makes it onto the dance floor with this guy. And this is juxtaposed with her son at home getting busy with his girlfriend. And as they're having their roll in the hay, the dress starts babadooking across the ceiling and then drops down on her and tries to suffocate her. I don't remember either of their names. The girlfriend's name, the model's name.
Gwen is the girlfriend's name. I can't remember the son's name.
Later on, Sheila has brought this new paramour back home, and he's goading her into putting the dress on. Looks so good on you, put it on. And she obliges him, and they go out for a walk in the countryside, and she is set upon by a dog, who I think we're meant to assume is trying to attack the dress rather than its wearer. In, you know, classic horror movie fashion, animals are a little quicker on the uptake when it comes to these things. And the dress is ripped, torn to shreds, damn near, and then mysteriously assembles itself, reassembles itself, stitches itself back together. When Sheila's back is turned, it's returned to her in perfect condition, and she's not having that.
Yeah.
We get another scene with the Bobs, where things take a turn for the Kafka-esque, and they start grilling her about her dreams. They're trying to find out what's made her a less than perfect employee. And she says, oh, just a few sleepless nights, whatever. And they say, you know, tell us about it. And then she regales them with this crazy dream that she had, the details of which escape me. It had something to do with her mother.
Yeah, like found one of her mother's dresses and, oh, it smelled of her perfume. And then I put it on and got on the bus and everybody was hiding under the seats. Which prompts one of the guys to go, racists. Sheila is a black woman, incidentally.
Which felt like a very Bradley Whitford Get Out kind of note.
Yes, 1,000%. Very insincere wokeness,
mm-hmm.
Particularly given the period setting also.
Yeah, and what a hard time they've been giving her.
Right. And then she's like, I reeked of death. Mm-hmm. The bus driver vomited, and then we drove off a cliff.
And then I woke up.
Jesus.
So Sheila is not with us for much longer. I think the next scene of consequence is she's driving at night. I can't remember where. And
I think to go see her new boy toy.
And she sees a mannequin in the middle of the road, swerves to avoid it, crashes. And we get probably my favorite shot, or actually succession of shots in the movie, of red taillights illuminating the mannequin as shards of glass from the windshield rain down on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we see her crawling away from the wreckage, dying shortly thereafter. There goes our would-be protagonist. And somehow the dress hops to this nebbishy secondary protagonist, the white guy, a washing machine repairman. He's engaged to be married, and we meet him as he's getting ready for his bachelor party, which goes south because his mates are all Neanderthals. And he like spills beer on his shirt, and one of the other blokes is like, oh, I've got just the thing, and pulls out the red dress and makes him wear it on their night on the town.
Yeah. This is the most terrifying bachelor party I've ever seen.
Oh, you said it was more like a fraternity hazing, which is pretty spot on.
Yeah.
Aren't
bachelor parties supposed to be fun
for the bachelor?
The bachelor.
Theoretically.
Yes, I think so.
This one ends with him puking in a parking lot somewhere. It's one of the grossest vomiting scenes I've seen in quite some time. The stuff that comes out of him looks like mango salsa. And his buddies are all carousing in the background.
One of them like puts a fucking pacifier in his mouth.
Yeah.
And then he vomits again. Just awful. Just
expels it like a champagne cork.
Yes.
Gross. So the film at this point becomes, I'm going to say two things, one of which is subjective, the other which is not. The film becomes, for me, a little less compelling at this point, and it certainly becomes more overtly comedic at this point, I would say. We follow him on his workaday routine, again, washing machine repairman, and the joke of this character is that every time he talks about his work, he bores people into a brain-dead stupor that almost borders on sexual ecstasy.
Yes. That's not clear the first time.
Uh-huh.
Some woman is having him repair her washing machine, and he just trails off into this speech, and she's just sort of, again, yeah, goes blank in the face. And I just assumed on that one that she was bored, particularly because she's trying to
Come on to him
and interrogate him about, like, oh, well, do you ever look at other women?
And he's just far too staid and fearful and faithful.
Right. But later on, when he gets, and this is taking things a little bit out of order, but later on when he gets laid off from
work.
He gets highly
disordered at this point anyway.
Sure. When he gets laid off from work because he has the temerity to repair his own washing machine without running it through the company.
Again, Kafka.
So his boss eats his employee ID in front of him.
It's quite a power move.
He's trying to get like a bridge loan or something from the bank. And They don't want to extend it to him, presumably because he's unemployed and therefore he's a credit risk.
It's the Bobs again.
It's the Bobs again, of course. And they're like, well, you know, when we met someone else who worked for your company, he explained to us the way you repair washing machines. It was very interesting. You know, would you like to talk about that? And Reg is kind of halting at first.
He gets this very flat affect whenever he starts talking about all the gizmos that are spinning and doing their business inside the washing machine and the belts and the whatchamacallits and everything that can go wrong with them.
Yeah. And at first he's getting himself tripped up and the guy's like, oh, this is clearly not working. And then they distract him for a while, bring it back to that. And then he goes into his flat stream of consciousness monotone.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Bobs is where it really appears to be. The sexual ecstasy.
Yes, their fingers intertwine, and they, one of them, he looks like he's falling asleep and wetting himself at the same time. That's the face. And also maybe having a mild stroke because one of his eyes closes and the other one is wide open. He just kind of goes slack.
Later on, he starts, or no, it's before, because it's when he's repairing his own washing machine. Uh-huh. He's explaining what happened to his fiance. His fiance goes fucking cross-eyed.
Yeah, it's like when, is it Bill Hader who looks into the deadlights in It Chapter 2?
Yeah, I think so. His
face just, mouth just falls open, looks like a dead fish.
Yeah, it's definitely Bill Hader.
That kind of face.
Yeah.
So that's a running gag. The Bobs also extort a dream description from him like they did with Sheila. And his nightmare is about watching his fiance give birth and the baby is wearing a miniature version of the red dress.
And it proceeds to give him the finger.
Yeah, it flips him a tiny bird. The dress is still up to no good. It, in the night, slithers over their bird cage and asphyxiates their pet bird.
His fiance has worn the dress at least once, if not multiple times.
And they've both gotten a rash, consequently.
Just like Sheila's.
It eventually asphyxiates him, messes with, was it carbon monoxide?
Yeah, it messes with, like, the furnace, essentially. And that was his theory for how the bird died. He's like, it might have been a carbon monoxide leak or whole. Oh, you're scaring me.
The dress taking notes.
Yeah, right. The dress is furiously writing here. And he tells his fiance, yeah, just check the pilot light or whatever. And as long as the flame doesn't turn orange, we're fine. File that away for a couple minutes from now.
Yeah, right.
The fiance goes to the same department store with Nosferatu and his vampire ladies. And she's looking around shopping and... was it Miss Luckmore? Whatever, the verbose one that we've dealt with the most.
Mm-hmm, the demon saleswoman.
She tries to usher her out, talk smack about the condition of the dress. She's wearing the red dress at this time, but I guess it's worse for wear. Who knew? Tries to usher her out of the store. Eventually, Dracula shows up, tells her to let her off the hook, and the fiance makes some crack about, like, you know, normally I wouldn't say this, but... you all need a good shagging, which they all find hilarious.
Yes, they start tittering because, you know, in a way that indicates, like, you can only imagine the kind of shagging we get up to behind closed doors.
Yeah. Fiance eventually finds a dress, a new dress for herself to buy, and she goes to changing room to try it on.
Meanwhile, there's an altercation between two other patrons at the checkout counter. I was here first. And they come to blows. It escalates to the point where the sales lady actually resorts to talking like a normal person. After all of her verbosity, she just is reduced to going, hey, ladies, stop.
This is intercut with...
it's like watching her poker face finally fail.
This is intercut with shots of Reg, the repairman, vegging out in front of the television and close-ups of their pilot light. It's actually like about 2 dozen or 3 dozen tiny flames in like a rose. It's nuts, turning orange from blue.
Uh-huh.
So I was like, oh, carbon monoxide's going to get Reg. Sure enough, he ends up dead after 3 or 4 cuts back and forth.
And what he's watching on the television as he expires is hallucinatory, jumbled up commercials for the department store.
Some of which we've seen before.
Responsible for all this mayhem, yeah.
But anyway, yeah, this fight turns into a straight up riot.
Yes.
Like they're looting the store and punching each other. The saleswoman has had her wig ripped off.
She slithers back into her dumbwaiter to get out of there.
And the store, there's a fire. I think the dress lands on a space heater. Fiance's trapped in her dressing room. She can't get out. It's just utter mayhem.
Flames spread, and we descend in the dumbwaiter through layers of the dress's previous victims working at sewing machines on, you know, level -1, -2 as we're descending deeper and deeper into the abyss.
Yeah, looks like they're making the red dress over again, essentially. Mm-hmm.
With
we see
their own blood, I think. There's like red thread that looks to be coming out of their veins, almost like an IV.
Right. And it's the woman from the zebra crossing, and then it's Sheila, and then it's Reg. And they're, in addition to all like being at sewing machines, they're all wearing these sort of drab gray, I don't even know what to call them, like work dress frock things.
Yeah.
And so he looks as silly wearing that as he did wearing the dress, or perhaps even sillier when it gets to him. And then it's his fiance, and then there's just four or five floors where it's just the dress and the sewing machine, and there's nobody there yet.
Unmanned for now.
And between each floor, it cuts back to the saleswoman growing steadily more excited.
Following day, firefighter is exhuming the ashes of the burned-down department store and finds the dress untouched amongst the rubble. Roll credits.
Roll credits. So we'll go ahead and take our break, and then we'll be back with some commentary.
A purchase on a horizon?
I'm just looking, thank you.
The hesitation in your voice, soon to be an echo in the recesses of the spheres of retail. The dress is your image, onto what you project through an illusion.
I'm just going on a date. I don't normally wear this kind of thing.
Be bold. Your date will compliment you. I would like you to announce the numbers to your telephone.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at ShockDoctorsPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/ShockDoctorsPod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
I think something's wrong with that dress.
Don't tell me you're scared of a dress.
The dog ripped it to pieces.
Spank, spanking you almost.
Such a pretty dress.
Anything nice in the sales?
Just a dress.
And we're back. Matt, I imagine we both have a lot to say about this movie. Why don't you go first?
Peter Strickland is a little hit or miss for me, and I think this movie has hits and misses in it. I made it sound like, I mean, the movie is split pretty much cleanly down the middle between Sheila and what's-his-name, Reg.
Yeah.
And while I liked the Sheila stint more, the Reg stuff still has things to recommend it. I thought that the tone just got a lot lighter. The schism doesn't bother me. If anything, I just would have made the first half the more farcical of the two and had things get a little heavier as you move along. But that's because I'm partial to horror movies that really kind of bum you out or actually try to unsettle you, rattle your bones a little bit.
The endings are dire.
Yeah, whereas this movie only gets easier to digest as it goes along, which seems a little bit counterintuitive with that ending where you're kind of taking a trip into hell watching these souls being tormented in what I take to be a kind of afterlife. Or kind of turpitude that they're trapped in.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that would have had more of an impact if we'd met Sheila after Reg, because her life and her story is a little bit more on the serious side. But Strickland is a little bit of a prankster god, so he might have done that on purpose. A little bit of a mischief deity. He reminds me of Peter Greenaway in that way. Both powerfully British and kind of sly and sardonic and arch, more than anything. That's the word we keep using.
Deeply strange.
Yeah, and willfully flout the censors in much the same way.
Yeah.
I thought of Bad Hair again watching that last scene. It reminded me of the Hair Plantation epilogue from that movie. But whereas in Bad Hair, we were, you and I, pardon the pun, splitting hairs over, like, was that supposed to be literal? Or was it just totally metaphorical? Or it couldn't have been completely metaphorical because what's-his-face was there.
James, like, Vanderbeek.
Right. And so we kind of were hemming and hawing about that and found it kind of unsatisfying. Here, it plays more like music or poetry, and it is kind of more abstract, and I didn't have any issues with trying to parse what layer of reality I was looking at.
Right.
It felt much more like a flight of fancy, which I might be an advantage of the movie's structure, the way it's set up now, where it does get a little bit sillier as you wade deeper into it. It's possible that had Sheila come after Reg, that ending would have been a little bit more confusing on the order of bad hair, where you're trying to figure out whether you're meant to take it at face value or not.
I think that ending probably would have played about the same.
Probably.
Regardless.
Yeah, I may be overthinking it.
Which segment you had there, yeah. Because, I mean, even the Sheila stuff, it is less comedic, you're right, and it is more coherent, but it's also not really, I guess, less strange.
Yeah, well, the Bob's stuff is the same in both halves.
Yeah, the Bob's stuff is the same.
So that's a major consistency. And then her dates also have the same absurdist humor in them that much of Reg's interactions do.
Yeah. And obviously the interactions with the saleswoman are similar across both. So I think it probably, there's still enough weirdness in the Sheila half of this movie that it could have segued into that closing sequence seamlessly relative to how the second segment did.
And in fairness, I just want to call it Equestrian Vortex. What is that movie actually called?
Barbarian Sound Studio.
Yes, thank you. Barbarian Sound Studio is Strickland doing more of a straight psychological horror movie, and I was lukewarm on it, so maybe it's wrong of me to rap him across the knuckles for getting silly with it, because I think that it might play a little bit better that way. I thought Barbarian Sound Studio didn't have quite enough going on. I found it a little bit slight.
Mm-hmm.
But I like Duke of Burgundy a lot, actually.
Yeah, and that's the one I haven't seen, so I can't really weigh in on it.
Duke of Burgundy has this motif of moths and butterflies and this kind of entomological thing to it. And a lot of sort of non-narrative sequences in that movie are patched together. The butterflies are almost used as an adhesive to hold the shots together. You get, you know, superimpositions of like people's faces with butterflies happening on a different layer of celluloid. And there's stuff like that in this movie too. It's usually a character will be going into a fugue of some kind, and then you'll see the dress flapping as in a breeze, mm-hmm. you know, like on a clothesline, this ghost-like sort of flapping. And I think that I got tired of seeing. I think it's functionally the same as the butterfly stuff in Duke of Burgundy, but just less effective for me for whatever reason. Maybe just less interesting to look at once you've seen it once or twice. The dress has a surprising amount of personality when it's slithering around the ground or the walls or the ceiling and setting booby traps, you know, like that's cute. But the way that it's incorporated into the montage occasionally felt like overkill. There's never a moment when Strickland couldn't cut to it if he felt like it.
Right.
And a little of that goes a long way, I think.
Yeah, I like the when the dress is inching across the ground, because
like a little inchworm. Yeah, like,
well, yeah, and it's so lo-fi too. Uh-huh. It's like clearly they just had a PA like tugging on the dress
on like a fishing line. Yeah, right.
it's very charming. I know the way I just pitched it makes it sound stupid, but it works
well. And you get those 70s credits, you want something a little lo-fi, a little,
well, yeah, tactile. It definitely fits that ethos for uh-huh. sure. And we talked about how it opens with that, you know, with the credits being in that same, that sort of 70s font, and the music being very Goblin with a little bit of Tangerine Dream, as Matt was saying.
Like a little grated tangerine, just like, you know, just as a kind of
a garnish.
A garnish, thank you.
A garnish on my Goblin.
It'll be the title of Strickland's next film.
Or Dario Argento's memoirs.
Right.
So, obviously, like we said, that's all there in the opening, but it does extend throughout the film. The whole film is very, very 70s, and so the dress inching around on the ground, it doesn't feel out of place in the rest of the movie either. It's not like, oh, this is a thing that really would have fit in the opening credits, but now it makes no sense. It fits throughout. The production design all feels very period appropriate, and the soundtrack remains very Goblin.
Yeah.
And it's got a very giallo color palette, and I'm not just talking about the dress, because obviously it's fucking bright red, duh, but everything else around it too also has that quality to it.
Yeah, visually the movie is rather nice. I already praised the shot of the mannequin in the road being showered with glass, you know, the red coming off the tail lights and everything. A nice silhouetting effect there on the mannequin's, you know, blank face, eerie. Where Slender Man stands here on the Shock Doctors. Sure. That's just like that's a classic image, just like a Uncanny Valley kind of thing, a face that isn't a face.
Yeah. Well, and there's one mannequin in particular that keeps recurring. It's the one that's in the road when Sheila crashes. It's the one it becomes most predominant on the TV as Reg is being asphyxiated. And Uncanny Valley is the right phrase for it, because there are mannequins that barely have any hint of features on the head, and then it's just like, okay, it's a mannequin. That's what mannequins look like. But this one, its features are a little too defined.
Right.
It's a little too human, but not nearly human enough.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. It
really hits that sweet spot.
It's unpleasant to look at.
There's another shot I like. Sheila is lecturing her son because the dress has been moving around of its own volition, and she found it, I think, in his room, and so she assumes that his girlfriend pilfered it.
Right.
And she's not thrilled about that. You know, I don't like people going through my things. And they're standing against this, I can't remember if it's wallpaper or if there's a light behind them, but it's this brilliant bright yellow. It looks like there's a Lion King sunrise coming up behind them. Really eye-catching, and the movie is, it's not, you know, eye-popping in a Suspiria way, you know, Argento's Suspiria, where it's just breathtaking routinely, but every once in a while you'll get a shot like that does give you some of those giallo shivers, which I quite like.
And obviously we just touched on one mannequin in particular, but there's a lot of mannequin business in this movie, which I again think is very giallo. I mean, I'll defer to Matt as the resident giallo expert between the two of us.
Yeah, but Mannequin 2 on the Move is one of my favorite Fulci movies. I haven't seen either of the Mannequin movies. I just know that Starship song from the first one.
Right. There's a shot that's got a still frame in the opening sequence, but then it's also during the climax with the riot where a mannequin is like melting amidst the flames. Mm-hmm. And that was, again, very genre appropriate.
Yeah, well, that reminded me of House of Wax, which is sort of a proto giallo in the masked slasher going around with like the leather gloves and the sort of porcelain face that eventually gets smashed, revealing the hideous scarred Vincent Price visage underneath. Sort of, you know, it's a 50s horror melodrama with Vincent Price, but it's got some giallo elements way ahead of the curve in that way. I would be surprised if it wasn't a foundational influence for Argento and his cohorts and his contemporaries.
Obviously we talked at length about the mannequin orgy, I guess you might call it.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously that's more unsettling mannequin business that goes on,
but also comical, because you've got this very old Nosferatu looking man, as I said, making O faces. And the whole thing has an air of the ridiculous about it.
Yes.
Inescapably.
And also there are these interstitial montages throughout the movie that I don't think we've touched on yet, where they go rapid fire through. They look like 70s still photos of people shopping or just people going out around their business,
just foot crowds traffic, of people. A lot of it, yeah.
And they consistently end with like a mannequin hand.
Right.
Appearing very abruptly. And not coincidentally, I don't think, this mannequin hand very much resembles the saleswoman doing her tiger claws hands.
Right, yeah, it's got red fingernails. Talons.
Which she consistently does have. This movie's big into mannequins, I guess, is the upshot of this long discourse on mannequins.
And you could read a lot into that, or you could not. Again, you know, femininity and vanity and consumerism and a lot of different isms. but the movie invites that stuff without insisting on it. Because it's at the end of the day, it's a little too impish and a little too mischievous to really try to ram any one particular reading down your throat.
Mm-hmm.
It's more open-ended, I would say, than Barbarian Sound Studio, for example, which did seem to kind of be insisting on this idea that Toby Jones was being somehow psychologically or spiritually polluted by the work that he was doing. That's all another movie that's very giallo, which is my favorite aspect of it. He's a sound artist, right? He's like a sound designer or Foley guy working on a sleazoid Italian slasher movie that's beneath him. He's like slumming it.
Right.
And unraveling over the course of the production. And I like the world that it occupies, but I didn't buy that, you know, just from swimming in those waters, he would fall to pieces. It didn't seem like it's like this kind of Lynchian psychological dissolution that happens to him. And I just didn't think it was warranted. It almost seemed like kind of, it was a weirdly kind of stuffy position for someone like Peter Strickland, who doesn't seem like he'd be easily scandalized.
Right.
You'd think it would take a lot more than that to drive any of his characters mad, no matter how stuffy they even might be.
Well, yeah, considering that 6 years later, he's got a movie where Angus Scrim ass man is jerking off to a mannequin orgy.
Right, sending cum ropes across the screen.
Four or five different shots, I feel like. It keeps cutting back to that, you know, black background with the gouts. Unreal. Yes.
Rated NC-17 for violence, strong language, and gouts of jizz. Coming soon to a theater near you.
Good for that guy, I guess, is all I can say. You know, a man at his age, the pipes are in good working order, yeah. Apparently.
That's hail Satan, I guess.
No, I guess.
He's doing something right. There's a great line that sort of, I think maybe cheekily or self-consciously, Strickland might have intended reviewers to apply to the film as a whole. It might have been kind of throwing us a bone on that. During one of the meetings with the Bobs, one of them accuses Sheila of having, and I quote, a core of inscrutability. And I thought, well, that's, you know, that's the long and the short of it, isn't it, Peter?
Well, the slightly modified reading in that direction is he's putting all of his potential critics in the position of these, again, Kafka minion fucking bosses
right.
at the bank. So he's discouraging people from being able to take that position.
Yeah, or possibly from reading too much into it, too, because the Bobs are also relentless dream analysts. They want to know what all the characters in this movie all refer to their dreams as sleeping dreams. Without fail, they say it very casually. I was just having a sleeping dream as opposed to a daydream, I guess.
Yeah, but I mean, like a waking dream is a phrase, but
sleeping dream is a redundancy.
Yeah, that's the default. You can just say dream.
I was having a food meal.
I went out on an exercise walk.
It's like instead of saying food for thought, food for stomach. Like, yeah, right. The normal kind.
Food for sustenance. I got here in my driving car.
You get the idea. So the little flourishes like that sprinkled throughout, which I think is maybe inherited from Peter Greenaway. He likes to weird language. Like that. I think that's an old Calvin and Hobbes joke. The line is verbing weirds language. Verbing weirds language. It's one stuck with me. So there's semantic tricks like that here and there.
This is a stupid thing to get hung up on at a time like this, but I'm trying to remember Brian Dennehy's character's name from The Belly of an Architect.
Never seen it.
It's a Peter Greenaway film. I'd expect you know that, but he's the title character, the architect, and he's got a name like Storley Cracklight or something. It's just impossibly odd. verbing weirds names, I guess is what I'm getting at.
Yeah, Bill Watterson didn't take it quite far enough, I guess. No, I haven't seen that one. I gotta get on that. I haven't seen that much Peter Greenaway, actually. I've seen Draftsman's Contract, which is great. Cook the Thief, etc. is very, very good. And I watched The Falls, which did nothing for me, but kind of seemed like a three-hour prank. So I don't know quite what to make of it, but I don't mind having seen it.
Yeah.
Amidst all of the absurdity of the back half of this movie, there was one blink and you miss it wake-up call that I liked. I can't remember, you for a second or two, you see a newspaper in the hands of the washing machine repairman, and the headline says something like bank clerk in tragic auto accident, or I think road accident is actually the phrase. And then he balls up the newspaper and I think either throws it out or stuffs it into his bird's cage or something.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't reading it, but we are reminded of what the first half of this movie is about, and now she's just yesterday's news.
Yeah.
And I thought that was rather neat.
Mm-hmm. Well, to get on to our recommendations, I could try to recommend some giallo movies. I think I'll leave that in Matt's hands. The tack I'm going to take instead is latching on to, again, the sort of Kafka vibe that, I mean, you get it definitely powerfully from The Bobs, but you also get it in Reg's interactions on two separate occasions with his boss, who is nonverbal both times, including the time when he eats an ID card.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot of Yorgos Lanthimos in this movie, too, I think.
Yeah,
The lobster kind of stuff.
Yes.
Well, and the favorite is also very much a Peter Greenaway pastiche, so I think that's the middle of this Venn diagram, potentially.
Yeah, I think you're right. Also,
the boss is straight out of a Yorgos Lanthimos movie.
Yes. And you also get a little bit of this vibe from the scenes immediately prior to each time we meet Reg's boss, where his coworker is like, you keep doing this, you know, you gotta talk to the boss or I'm gonna get in trouble, and I can't have that. Anyway, this all reminded me of a movie called The Double from 7 or 8 years ago. It's a Richard Ayoade film, if I recall correctly.
I believe you're right.
And it's based
on Jesse Eisenberg?
Yes.
Yeah. I haven't seen it, but I've been meaning to.
It's based on Dostoevsky, right?
Yes.
Okay.
I was supposed to read that for a teacher we had in high school, some like project, and I don't know if I actually did. So, George, if you're listening, I'm terribly sorry. I think I might have skimmed that one. Well, I liked what I read, but I when you brought up that film and then said the name Dostoevsky, I got like as
like a twinge of high school anxiety.
A twinge of fraud, kind of, you know, of imposter syndrome just overtook me. So I think I might have to atone for some past sins there. Anyway, carry on.
Yeah. The main character, played, as Matt said, by Jesse Eisenberg, is this corporate drone at this company that it's not really clear what they do. It reminds me of nothing so much as the censorship factory in the 1984 film with John Hurt.
Yes, the one from 1984.
Right.
Yes, I like that movie a lot.
Yeah, it's a good one. And he is taken aback when he meets someone else who comes to work at his place of employment who looks exactly like him. And I think his name is like the inverse of his own name.
Mm-hmm.
He's got one of those, like, say his name is Dave Jacobs. The other guy's name is like Jacob David or something. It's one of those. And this guy is, you know, much more self-confident and therefore becomes much more popular. Eventually comes in and Mr. Steals Yo Girls him.
Yeah.
And this eventually leads to...
It's like a Tyler Durden thing, but not a twist. It's like if they both looked like Edward Norton, from what
right.
I understand.
And they are literally two people.
Uh-huh.
As opposed to one being a hallucination. Anyway, this culminates in the first Jesse Eisenberg snapping. And yeah, it's the way the nebbish version has to interact with other people and with his bosses. The stuff with the Bobs in this movie just really reminded me of that aggressively. And it was equally funny but also unpleasant to contemplate. Like, Jesus Christ, I hope I'm never in the situation where I have to deal with people like that. God forbid.
I remember what it was. It was I was writing an essay contrasting the Dostoevsky story with William Wilson by Edgar Allan Poe, which is another psychological horror story about a doppelganger, which I have read several times and love dearly. So I have a feeling that it was like an 80-20 split, that paper I wrote. I have a feeling that Poe came out getting a lot more lip service, but that's as near as I can remember. That's how I got away with it. And for what it's worth, I do like William Wilson a lot and have actually read the damn thing more than once, although it's much shorter than the Dostoevsky. So what am I going to recommend? The movie I kept thinking of watching this, it's a British short, not a horror film at all. It's from the late 40s or early 50s. It's called In Which We Live, being the story of a suit as told by itself, I think is the full title. Not a horror movie. It's more of like a Pixar thing where, it's the story of a kind of shabby suit that, it's like a children's fable kind of thing where, I just want to be worn. I just want to be useful. I just want to keep somebody warm and look sharp and that kind of thing. And true to the title. It's the suit telling you its own story.
Right.
And I thought that was rather cute and charming. And it's a suit with a very different temperament. Although oddly, the amount of personality that the two articles of clothing have in these two movies is comparable, I would say. I mean, you can feel the diabolism of the dress in Fabric as much as you can feel the kind of affable underdog spirit of the suit in Which We Live. So I think they're probably the two movies I've seen where an article of clothing had the most spunk and the most vim. So I kept thinking about that movie for that reason, but I obviously would like to recommend a horror movie. I guess I'm going to recommend, and this is an early giallo. It's later than House of Wax. I mean, it's a proper giallo. It's Italian, for one thing. It's a Bava picture from, I want to say, 63 or 64, called Blood and Black Lace. And I'm picking this giallo in particular because it's set at a fashion academy, if memory serves, or a modeling school. Everyone's immaculately dressed, lots of high fashion, ankle-length dresses, and it's not about murderous attire per se, but everyone who is murdered in the film is wearing finery of the kind that you see in this movie. And it's got that chic European high fashion atmosphere to it. And that's a big part of the giallo style that Strickland is obviously aping in this movie. As the giallo cycle kind of wore on, they started getting more grindhousey, I find, sleazier.
Mm-hmm.
And some filmmakers started there. I think all Fulci's giallo movies are kind of that way. But at least with Bava and Argento, more so I would say even with Bava because he got his start sooner, they're a little artier and a little more... Yeah, I mean, you would hesitate to call them high art or high class because they're still slasher movies, but they are at least superficially respectable looking, pretty and kind of sleek and stylish. So honestly, Blood and Black Lace it's eye-popping in a Suspiria caliber sort of way. It's a little more by the numbers, in terms of the whodunit stuff. It's not about a coven. That's what really elevates Suspiria, in addition to the look, is the fact that it's got all this occult energy in it.
Sure.
Which makes it way up my alley. But I like a good slasher murder mystery too, masked killer kind of thing. So Blood and Black Lace is going to be my recommendation, I think. It's a pretty good introduction to the whole giallo genre if you're new to that sort of thing. Not a deep cut by any means, but a good place to start. I guess the phrase deep cut is always a little loaded when we're talking about this sort of thing.
Right. Well, I think on that note, we can wrap up yet another episode. So, until next time, I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. We'll see you later. As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from In Fabric Official Trailer HD A24, uploaded by A24. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, April 18th, and we will be discussing Tigers Are Not Afraid, a dark fairy tale about children caught up in cartel violence. See you then.